All right, well, today we're going to do a little tour through the concept of class. I want to do two main things. For probably 3/4 of the lecture, I'm going to be exploring this idea, this concept. So this is one of those times in the course where we're really going to try to bore down into a term you've all heard, class, social class. A lot of discussion in the news about it. You hear about middle class tax cuts, the declining middle class, working class, lower class, upper class. The word class gets used a lot in ordinary speech, in the popular media. It also gets used in sociology. And sometimes, in a social scientific discipline, there's a very close connection between ordinary language use of a term and the way it gets used when it's being used in a scientific analysis, a social scientific analysis. Other times, there's actually a distance between ordinary language use and the more technical meanings of a term inside of a discipline like sociology. Well, class is a particularly interesting concept around that issue. So part of what I want to do is to just play with the concept a bit and show you of how it gets used and how it gets increasing distance from just ordinary language use and yet retains a connection. So that's a lot of sort of theoretical work to do. That'll be about 2/3 of the class, maybe a little more. And then I'm going to use the machinery we get from that discussion to give you a very brief portrait of the American class structure as understood with the more theoretical concepts of sociology, not just the off-the-shelf, ordinary, everyday language use of the term. Yeah, that's a lot to accomplish, but I think you'll find this, I hope, an interesting exploration of words, concepts, and then the realities of the world. As a kind of background to this problem, I need to clarify a contrast between two different ways of even thinking about what we're talking about when we think about inequality. And one way of grasping this is a contrast between what can be called gradational ideas about inequality and relational ideas. Gradational and relational. Gradational inequality imagines that the world is kind of like a ladder, in which there are rungs. I'm sure you've heard this metaphor in one context or another. And you can locate people on this ladder from upper middle, middle, lower middle, lower. Maybe some people completely fall off the ladder. They're underneath the ladder. That's a gradational idea. People can be graded, they can be ranked on some kind of scale in which the difference between people is having more or less of something. More or less status, more or less wealth, more or less income, more or less education. More or less, that's what the gradational idea is. The relational idea of inequality is a lot more complicated. It defines a structure of social relations that bind together people who have advantages and disadvantages. It's not just that the people with advantages have more of something that the people without those advantages have less of, but rather that their lives are connected through a social relation of some sort. Capitalists and workers, lords and serfs, slave owners and slaves. That's a very different kind of idea. It's true, slave owners are much richer than slaves, but you would really be missing something fundamental if you said, well, the difference between slaves and slave owners is just rich and poor. You know, that would fundamentally misdescribe what's going on. Really, what's going on is that there's a particular kind of relationship between them. Indeed, it's a relationship in which you can't even define one of the terms without also defining the other, right? There's no meaning to the term of being a slave without there also being a slave owner. Some concepts, some positions that people occupy in the social world are relational, in the sense that to describe that particular position is also to describe how it's connected to another position. That's what a relation means. You know, you can't define the concept of wife without having the concept of husband if you're dealing in a world of ordinary, conventional marriage logics. The concept is defined via the relationship which binds it to another. Now, this is really important in the way we think about inequality, and as we'll see, it's really important for how we conceptualize the problem of class as a more technical idea in sociology. Let me illustrate this with two stories. You can relax about these stories. I mean, you can take notes. They're interesting stories. But this is really just to build the intuitions at what's in play in thinking about gradational versus relational ideas of inequality. So one story is the well-known Aesop fable, The Grasshopper and the Ant. I'm sure most of you know this classic tale. The Grasshopper and the Ant. At the end of the story, we have a huge inequality. You have a starving grasshopper and a prosperous ant in the winter when the grasshopper comes to the ant and asks for food. But at the beginning of the story, that's what's crucial. What do we have? We have two critters living in the in this imaginary world, and the grasshopper is hopping about enjoying the summer, and the ant is busily working. And the grasshopper says to the ant, "Why are you working so hard? What's the point? Look, plenty of food around. You can just hop around and enjoy yourself." And the ant says, "I'm working hard because I need to save. I have to work hard in order to accumulate resources to survive the winter." And the grasshopper says, "Ha, unnecessary. You're just crazy to be working that hard. Look, we live in a world of great bounty." Well, you know the story. Winter comes, the ant is happy, living the good life with all the stored food, and the grasshopper is starving. Now, if you wanted to explain the inequality at the end of the story, you would not invoke anything about the relationship between grasshoppers and ants. You would just say, aha, we have two different kinds of critters. They each have certain kinds of dispositions, attributes, proclivities. We've got, and this is the point, of course, of the fable, we have the hard-working, serious, prudential ant and the carefree, lazy, short-sighted grasshopper. These are descriptions that don't require the description of the other. You can just describe the grasshopper. Even if there were no ants, you could describe the grasshopper and explain why the grasshopper was miserable in the winter, just by virtue of the attributes of that particular critter. That would be a gradational account of their inequalities at the end of the story. There's differences in their attributes which get turned into different magnitudes of their conditions of life. But entirely due to the way those attributes direct the behavior of the particular character in the fable. They don't have anything to do with each other. I mean, they happen to have this conversation in the summer. That's, of course, for the narrative purposes of making it a good fable, but that's not part of the explanation for why they end up where they are. All right, here's another story. You have a university class with a really nasty professor, not me, I promise you, this is some other character. And he has this absolutely horrific grading system. In his classes, only one person gets an A. Only one person gets a B. Half of the class, almost except for the two, gets C's, and 10 people always fail. He insists that there has to be 10 failures. There has to be a big bulk of C's and one A and one B. The students in the class study for their exam, and at the end of the process, we observe that the student who worked the hardest got the A in this particular story. If we just count how hard they worked by how many hours they spent studying and how much they concentrated on their studies when they were studying, the student who worked the second hardest got the B, and so on. Mary got an A. Now, if you wanted to ask the question, why did Mary get the A? It's not false to say Mary got the A because she worked the hardest. And Joe got the B because he worked the second hardest. But there's something dreadfully missing about this account, right? It's missing the background condition in which there was only one A to be got. You wouldn't really be explaining the inequality among students in this story just by looking at their individual efforts, even though you could fully explain where they end up in the distribution. You see that point? That understanding everything about Mary tells you why she ends up on top, but it doesn't tell you why the top is the way it is. It doesn't tell you anything about the character of that position. Now, that would be called a structural account of inequality. A structural account. There is a separate explanation of the nature of the structure than there is of how people get allocated into the positions in the structure. Whereas in the first story, you don't need an account of the structure. All you need is an account of attributes. And the attributes themselves sort people out into inequalities, simply because the inequalities are just the playing out of the attribute. Whereas in the grading of the class story, there is actually a social structure into which people are being sorted. And their attributes may help explain where they end up, but not why there is a there to end up in of a particular character. Well, relational accounts of inequality, and then of class, as we will see, are all attempts at understanding the nature of the structure into which people are sorted, to give an independent account of the nature of the structure of social relations which are available for people, rather than seeing the social outcomes as simply a consequence of the attributes of persons. Okay, that's the background idea. Now let's turn to the problem of class. There are three approaches to the idea of class. These are all present in sociology. You know, you can find them in different things you'll read if you continue in taking sociology courses. These can be called the individual attributes and material conditions of life approach to class, the opportunity hoarding approach to class, and most controversially, the exploitation and domination approach to class. This last one is really loaded and very controversial. The second one is pretty conventional in sociology. The first one is the way of using the concept of class that's closest to the way it's used in everyday language. So let's look at the logics of each of these. First, individual attributes and conditions. Class is defined by clusters of individual attributes connected to unequal material conditions of life. So it's clusters, it's this kind of coincidence between attributes which you can observe just by looking at individuals and the unequal material conditions of life in which they live. The attributes that are typically discussed in this approach to class are things like education, sometimes what is called cultural capital, which is a little different from education. It's all the ways of of interacting in the world and the knowledge you have about how to behave in different kinds of contexts and so on. Education, sometimes psychological attributes like how resilient are you, how hardworking, how persistent are you, how lazy are you. Those are the kind of grasshopper and ants sort of attributes. Sometimes those are considered relevant attributes. So you have a whole set of individual attributes, and then you have material conditions of life, living comfortably, living badly, having high income, low income, being wealthy, unwealthy. These are all the kind of material conditions that shape your life. And where there is a correspondence between the individual attributes and the material conditions of life, then we say this is class. Class is a way of describing the connection between the set of individual attributes people have and the material conditions of life in which they live. So this enables you to have a kind of picture of a class structure, or a class system, one might say, in which there's a very tight connection between your attributes and your outcomes, or a less tight connection. Maybe it gets scrambled a bit. Maybe there are some attributes which give people advantages and other attributes which give people disadvantages. And those attributes may not be completely connected to each other. And thus, the connection between all of the attributes and how well you do in life gets loose. So we would describe a society as having a very sharp set of classes when there's a very tight connection between these, and a kind of fuzzier class system when there's a very weak connection. Okay, that's the individual attributes. That pretty much corresponds to the way I think most usages of class, what they're really talking about. When we hear in the news politicians talking about the importance of a middle class tax cut, what do they mean? They mean a tax cut basically for people who are more or less in the middle of the distribution of material conditions of life. They're really just talking about tax cuts for people with middling levels of income and middling levels of wealth. That's all that middle class tax cut means. That's the gradational idea of inequality connected to the attributes, the grasshopper and ant attributes of the persons. The next two approaches to class, both of them are structural rather than gradational. They're asking questions not just about how people end up with particular material conditions of life, which is what the first perspective focuses on. They're asking how do we understand the nature of the positions into which people move? Not just why some people are sorted to the top and other to the bottom, but why do we have a top and the bottom of a particular character? These are structural accounts of inequality. When those structural accounts of inequality then are turned into an account of class, the idea is to try to identify the social relations involved in defining this structure, the social relations involved. The first approach is what has come to be known. This is a relatively recent term. I suppose in the last 20 years, it really wasn't the way this was discussed further back than that. But in the last 20 years, this has become a kind of fashionable way of talking about this second approach. It's called the opportunity hoarding approach. Class is defined as economically unequal social positions protected by some process of social exclusion. Social exclusion. That is, you occupy a position that's unequal, but that unequal position is not simply the result of your attributes. That unequal position is protected in some way by a process of social exclusion. And social exclusion implies a social relation between those who are inside and those who are outside, between those included and those excluded. A good example is credentials. When you get a credential, it gives you an ability to occupy certain kinds of jobs, which you could not occupy without that credential. But the credential really should be thought of as a way of excluding people. It's primarily a device for reducing the access to those jobs by other people. Or think about property rights. This is a even more fundamental form of exclusion. When we describe a firm as being privately owned by a set of owners, let's call them capitalists just as a shorthand. There's more complicated ways that people can own firms, but let's just be simple about it for the moment. Well, if the workers in that firm are unhappy with their wages and they decided to take over the firm and run it themselves, right? That's has happened historically from time to time. Well, of course, they would be prevented from doing so. The police would be called in, they'd be arrested and thrown out of the firm, thrown out of the enterprise. Well, why is that the case? It's because their access to those means of production, to the buildings and machinery of the factory or of the office, their access to it is based on a set of property rights, which are basically power relations which allow for the exclusion of people from access according to the rules by which those property rights are enforced. The relation between the employees and the employer, therefore, is not simply one of the employer having advantages and the employee having disadvantages, but rather the employer owns the means of production and has a set of power relations which define his or her capacity to exclude other people. And that relationship of exclusion and inclusion, that's what's referred to as opportunity hoarding. A lot of what credentials do is enable the credential holder to hoard a certain kind of opportunity. Hoarding means just, it's a kind of metaphor here. It means that you're able to restrict access to those resources by other people. Jobs in this particular case. I mean, imagine what the market, the labor market for doctors or engineers would be if the United States suddenly said, we will have open borders with no restrictions of in the labor market for anybody who can do the work of doctoring. And they have to prove that they're competent. You know, they can do that with an exam. Or they can do it by having a certified medical degree from any certified medical institution, you know, teaching institution around the world. The same for engineers. But we'll have a universal global labor market for credentialed labor. Well, of course, the implication of that would be there would be vastly more competition for the positions of engineer, doctor, and so on. If there was unlimited, unrestricted immigration around those positions, and it would drive down the wages of people in those positions. If anybody who simply could do the job was able to compete for it. Well, the restrictions that we impose upon access to those jobs is what provides for the particularly strong advantages that people have by virtue of being in those jobs. And that's referred to as opportunity hoarding. Okay, that's a second way that the concept of class is used. That's often used to describe what's distinctive about professionals, for example, professional and technical workers, that aspect of what is loosely called the middle class. Well, these are people who don't merely earn more than the average person, but they have a special kind of skill that's ratified publicly. And that's what gives them their capacity to have higher than average earnings. The third concept of class is, as I said, the most controversial, the most contentious. This concept is rooted in these two fairly loaded terms, exploitation and domination. Class is defined as economically unequal social positions that are bound together through relations of exploitation and domination. Exploitation and domination. Domination is the easier of these two terms, just understand. I mean, anybody who's gone to work in a conventional factory or office in which they have a supervisor or a boss knows what it means to enter into a social relation characterized by domination. That is, when you enter such a social relation, such a workplace, you are told what to do. Somebody else controls your activities. Now, there are special kinds of workplaces in which you enter the workplace and you tell yourself what to do, pretty much. You have a lot of autonomy. That would be a very different kind of social relation than a workplace in which you have to follow orders from somebody who is directing your human activity rather than it being self-directed. One of the pleasures of being a professor is the enormous privilege, really, in the world in which we live, to have a huge amount of control over what I do. I direct my own labor. I mean, once I've decided to give a course like this one, I do show up. I do have obligations, but they're obligations which I have chosen. And pretty much, if you just count the number of hours of the day in which I'm doing something because I'm told to do it versus doing something because I want to do it and choose to do it, I'm basically living a life where I almost fully direct my own activity. Well, that's extremely rare in the world in which we happen to live. It corresponds to a certain ideal about human autonomy and self-direction, self-determination. But it's not the characteristic relationship into which people enter when they enter the workplace. And a characteristic of most workplaces is that when you enter into those jobs, you enter into a relationship of domination. That's the easier of these two ideas. The second one is a bit tougher, the concept of exploitation. And that's the concept of exploitation is also really a loaded idea. It has a moral inflection to it. I mean, nobody would say, I'm exploiting you, and isn't that a lovely thing? You know, for one person to exploit another is to say there's something unsavory about this relationship. But what exactly is being talked about? And is this a reasonable way of characterizing the character of the relations that bind together people when they enter many kinds of workplaces? Well, I want to elaborate the concept of exploitation for you by telling you another story, which will be a little more outrageous in some ways than the previous one. This is going to be a digression, maybe a digression of the form of light entertainment. But I've used this story in my own published work as a way of really explaining what the idea of exploitation is all about, and to make it seem more familiar, to make it comprehensible without a lot of very fancy theoretical argument. So this is a story that will help not merely to illustrate the idea of exploitation, but to help us understand what's really the fundamental feature of such relations and why then it has the particular moral texture it has. This is a story that comes from a comic strip called Little Abner, which ran in the United States from the 1930s through the 60s. Al Capp was the writer. And I'm going to tell you and act out in a half-baked sort of way a particular episode from Little Abner. This was published in 1948 when I was a baby. The background of the story is this. Little Abner is a hillbilly. He lives in a town called Dog Patch, which is located in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas. It is a completely decrepit, destitute village, basically, where nobody works hard and everybody is poor and bedraggled. Little Abner spends a lot of his time avoiding a woman in the village named Daisy May, who's constantly trying to catch him. There's something called Sadie Hawkins Day, which may ring a bell to some of you. It's an annual day in Dog Patch where in these ancient times the girls were able to force the boys to kiss them, and the boys always tried to get away. Well, that's the character of this pretty silly comic strip. Well, there's an episode in Little Abner in which another character is introduced called the Shmoo. The Shmoo. The Shmoo is a critter about this big. As you'll see shortly, it looks like a pear with whiskers. This background story is that in World War II, the army dumped radioactive waste in the mountains of the Ozarks, and some mutation occurred, and the shmoo came out of the process. My own hypothesis, although this is, I have no data to support this, is that the shmoo is a mutation of a wild turkey. They kind of look like a featherless wild turkey, too. The shmoo has three properties. They have only one purpose in life, which is to serve the needs of human beings. They do so by turning themselves into things you need. They can read your mind, so you don't even have to ask them. They just do it if they're in your presence. They figure out what you need, and they turn themselves into, you know, a jar of milk. They don't turn themselves into luxuries. So if you wake up in the morning and want a bowl of oatmeal, the shmoo will turn itself into a bowl of oatmeal. But if you want a plate of caviar for breakfast, the shmoo won't oblige. And because they're so concerned with the well-being of human beings, they replicate themselves before they transform themselves. So you never run out of them. The shmoo, this is now a little theological digression, the shmoo taps into the deep origin myth of Western civilization. The origin myth of Adam and Eve takes place in the Garden of Eden. And when they get kicked out of the Garden of Eden for eating of the tree of knowledge, you know, when God imposes punishments on Adam and Eve, lots of punishments like mortality. But one of the punishments is, from now on, you have to earn your bread by the sweat of your brow. Right? That's one of the punishments when you are kicked out of paradise. What the shmoo does is basically restore you to the Garden of Eden with respect to that one punishment. Because if you have shmoos, you don't have to earn your bread by the sweat of your brows. The shmoo provides you unlimited bread, bread being the metaphor for basic necessities. With a shmoo, you can live a life without toil. That is, you never have to do something you don't want to do in order to live. You might have to toil if you want to live better than basic needs, but your basic needs are just automatically given forever. Manna from heaven. That's what the shmoo provides. Okay, that's the background. Now our episode. Is that clear enough, or should I dim the lights a little? Can you read it, see it all? Okay. The background here is that these two gentlemen are coming to Dogpatch to check out a site for a new factory. A rich industrialist and his chief manager are going for a site visit.
And now, P.U., we're coming to a spot where folks are so ignorant they'd never dream of asking for more than we're willing to pay. And they'll never get rich on that. Here they haven't been spoiled by that silly fad of working a mere 8-hour day. These miserable rats are in such desperate need that they'll work for a good old-fashioned 16-hour day. You're a bright boy. How did you find such splendid spot to move our factory? Statistics show that there are more undernourished people in Dogpatch than any place. Those are the kind I like to deal with. They're so grateful, bless them. These poor, ignorant wretches will be grateful for the chance to work 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. They've never heard of anything better, and we'll never tell them. Oh, you're a bright lad. The board may well give you a $500,000 bonus again this year. Remember, this is $1948. That's probably $8 or $9 million bonus, something in that order of magnitude. Maybe we can pay him even less. Question him. How would you like to earn $7 a week? Did you say $7 for just 1 week? Oh, no, I said six. That would have been a tremendous fortune, B.S. What do you mean, B.S.? Before schmooze. Only 18 hours of hard labor a day? Only 7 days a week? And you'd pay us $6 for just that? That would have been a mighty juicy proposition, B.S. Meaning, before schmooze. But nobody what's got schmooze has to work anymore. And anybody can have them for free. Schmooze does everything.
Everything? I suppose they provide you with the necessities of life. Milk, butter, eggs, meat.
Stop. Stop laughing, you fool. Look. Great Scott, P.U., do you realize what the schmoo means? Nobody'll have to work hard anymore. I want to just make a slight editorial comment here. There's a disagreement between the residents of Dogpatch and the industrialist and his assistant about the implication of the schmoo. So to just backtrack and to quote the Dogpatchian, nobody what's got schmooze has to work anymore. Meaning that what the schmoo does is interferes with the labor market. You don't have to sell your labor power. You don't have to work anymore. But the industrialist realizes there's actually something else going on. Nobody who has a schmoo, nobody'll have to work hard anymore. That is, the problem is you won't get effort out of people. It's hard to get effort, to extract effort from them if they have a schmoo. Whereas the Dogpatch resident just says you won't have to go to work anymore. For those of you who are destined to become sociologists, one could say that the Dogpatch resident is a Weberian, a devotee of Max Weber, famous early 20th century sociologist, whereas the industrialist is a Marxist, understanding the structure of exploitation in the factory. Okay, enough of that. Back to the story. But who will do the long, dreary, backbreaking labor in our canning factories? Nobody. And what's worse, nobody will need our canned stuff anymore. The schmoo provides all types of food, fresh and free. Free food for everybody. That's horrible. The schmoo must go. It's either it or us. Thank heavens its sinister influence hasn't spread yet. Blast you, Wormley. Why are you stopping? Because I've quit. I snuck a brace of schmooze under my coat and dog patch. Now I've got a whole herd of them. I'll never have to take your guff anymore, P.U.
Back in New York. I'll forget the menace of the schmoo by taking Choo-Choo to dinner. That poor showgirl has been unemployed so long, she'll even go out with me for a square meal. Oh, I'd love to go to dinner with you, honeypot. I'll get you a steak and...
You can take that steak and slap your own fat face with it.
There's good schmooze tonight. That's the end of the story, of the episode that I'll show you. What happens, just so you know, the sequel, industrialist hires the mafia to go to Dogpatch to exterminate the schmooze. And because the schmooze are so eager to please people, they just line up and the mafia shoots them down. But little Abner rescues a couple of them and takes them off to a hidden place in the mountains. And so the schmoo continues to play a role in this saga after their initial demise. This last little bit about Choo-Choo, the showgirl, is pretty interesting because this is 1948. This comic strip occurred before the era when feminism and women's liberation was a common sort of broad perspective among intellectuals, whereas the idea that industrialists might dominate and exploit their workers, that was a kind of common thing that a lot of people would talk about and think about. The class issue was familiar. The gender issue was not. Al Capp is no feminist. I mean, if you read his comic strips, you're struck by how just totally sexist his characterizations of characters were, and without irony. He's just a old-fashioned, mid-20th century sexist. However, he added this bit, I think, because he was just following out the logic of the story. In a sense, he was engaged in an implicit theoretical bit of sociology. He was saying, well, let's suppose we had a world with schmooze. What would it do to different kinds of relations? Well, it would disrupt class relations because it would make it tougher for the industrialist to recruit a labor force. Ah, and it would disrupt gender relations, because if you had material independence for women, then they could say no. Autonomy, because of the shmoo, gives you a particular kind of freedom, the freedom to say no, the freedom to exit. Pretty crucial kind of freedom, the freedom to say no. Pretty fundamental to the value of freedom, the ability to say no. Well, he wasn't particularly advocating, you know, women's liberation for sure, but he did see that it was a logical implication of the shmoo. And I think he's right. The logical implication of the shmoo is that it would disrupt all sorts of relations of domination because of the way in which it would enable people to exit those relations. Okay, well, that's the story of the shmoo. Now let's do some theoretical work with it in order to understand its implications for this problem of the character of class relations in this third and more complex perspective on class, that is the domination and exploitation approach. So first we'll do a little exercise. Rank ordering the preference of different classes for the fate of the shmoo. So in this very stylized, simple story, there are really only two classes of people in the story. There are the rich industrialist and his chief executive officer. There's the kind of capitalist class, you can call them the rich. And there is the working class, or you could call them the poor. The working class in the sense of the people that the capitalist class is trying to recruit to the factory. And note that the residents of Dogpatch say that they would be eager to have worked in the factory if they didn't have shmooze before shmooze. So they were certainly a potential labor force for this factory. Now there are four fates for the shmoo, four things that can happen to the shmoo. Everybody can get a shmoo. Nobody gets it. Destroy the shmoo. Only the poor get it. Only the working class. Only the people who need it most get it. Or only the people who are already advantaged get it. Right? So with two classes and the shmoos either exist or don't exist, there are these four possibilities. Everybody gets it. Nobody gets it. The rich get it. The poor get it. Now let's ask, what's the rank ordering of preference of each of these classes? If you ask somebody in the first class, what would you like to see most happen to the shmoo? And if that's not possible, what's second and third and fourth? And you're only allowed to think about what's good for you. You know, you can't be a rich person who really deeply cares about the poor. You're just caring about yourself. So we're asking for your selfish interests. This doesn't imply that wealthy people are always selfish in this way. No, there are many who are extremely benevolent. It's just saying, what would be your class interests? Class interests mean the interests that benefit you, per se, period. Not interests that are taken into consideration the well-being of others. So what's the rank ordering for the capitalist class? Well, their first choice would be only capitalists get the shmoo, because after all, capitalists eat oatmeal. So a rich person is slightly better off if they have a shmoo than if they don't have a shmoo. Their second choice is destroy the shmoo. If they can't keep it exclusively for themselves, they would rather that nobody get it. The third choice is everybody gets a shmoo. Well, if you can't destroy them and you can't monopolize them, well, you might as well have everybody get them, because then at least you get them as well. And the worst option is only those who need them the most get it. That's at the bottom of the list. Well, what about workers? What's their first choice? Well, this isn't quite so obvious as for the capitalists, but their first choice is actually that everybody gets a shmoo. The reason is this. Many workers will actually want to still work. They will want to earn an income because, remember, the shmoo only provides for basic needs. It restores you to the Garden of Eden. You don't have to earn your bread by the sweat of your brow, but you will have to earn your airplane ticket to go to the Bahamas for a nice summer vacation by the sweat of your brow. So any worker who wants discretionary income, wants to live above basic needs, will have to earn an income. And all things considered, it's better to work for a capitalist who has a shmoo than one who doesn't. Because a capitalist with a shmoo will be a richer capitalist, have a little more flexibility, and so the wages in a firm in which the owners also have shmoos are likely to be a little bit higher. So first choice is everyone gets a shmoo. Second choice is only workers get the shmoo. Third choice is only the rich get the shmoo. That is, workers would still be better off if the capitalist didn't have to spend money on oatmeal, because that would mean there'd be a little bit more income available by the owner when you bargain for wages. They would have a little bit more flexibility because they have more resources. And the worst option is destroy the shmoo. The worst option is destroy the shmoo. Now look at these two rank orderings. This is one way then of thinking about a class relation and the nature of the antagonism of interests that are bound together in that kind of relationship. These are not just different rank orderings, they're pretty sharply opposed rank orderings. You know, it's hard to imagine something more antagonistic. Antagonistic means there's a kind of intrinsic opposition, not just because of some misunderstanding or because of excessive greed. No, this is built into the character of the relationship itself. Very sharp conflict. But note another thing. If you were to ask some great moral leader how they would rank order the fate of the shmoo, you know, think of the great moral figures of history. Martin Luther King, Jesus, Buddha, you know, any of the powerful moral figures that humanity has respected for their moral judgment, I think their rank ordering would be pretty much the same as the rank ordering of the poor in this story. I mean, they would say if this great boon from heaven is possible, everybody should get it. And if it can't go to everybody, at least those who most desperately need it should get the boon, the manna from heaven. And if that's not possible, well, perhaps reluctantly, only the wealthy should get it, because at least some of that will trickle down, to use a favorite expression of the modern era, to the poor. And the worst option would be to destroy it on universalistic moral principles. Well, that's a pretty interesting coincidence, that the selfish rank ordering of the disadvantaged in these relationships also corresponds to a kind of universal, non-selfish rank ordering that would conform to moral principles. All right, so this is the first big step. We've gone from saying that when workers go into employment, they are dominated. That's kind of obvious, that the social relation into which they enter is one of domination. We've now added a more complex idea. They enter a relationship that has this kind of fraught interdependency and conflict of interests, which I'm labeling exploitation. Now I'm going to ratchet this up to one more level of abstraction. So we're now building this concept in a more complex way. This involves specifying three criteria for giving now real precision to the concept of exploitation. These criteria come out of the shmoo story, but really go beyond it. Now, this is pretty abstract and pretty complicated. It's not, I think, opaque. It's not that you can't understand it, but if this is the first time you've grappled with these kinds of ideas, you know, don't feel uncomfortable that it doesn't all quite fit together. In the reading for the class, I don't go through this level of detail in the book. What I'm presenting to you here is the ideas that I've developed in my kind of most theoretical writing around the problem of class. But I generally have the view that there's no reason not to share the most sophisticated versions of arguments, even in an introductory class like this, and even if it doesn't all get absorbed, because that's how you learn. You learn by getting things that are just a little bit beyond where you can fully grasp and integrate it into your own thinking, so that the next time you encounter ideas, they become more familiar. All right, so there are three criteria that define this package that we call exploitation. The first is called the inverse interdependent welfare principle. This is a situation where the material well-being of the advantaged group causally depends upon the material deprivations of the disadvantaged. So there's an interdependence of the well-being of the capitalist and the worker, the rich and the poor, in the Schmoo story. They're interdependent. But the well-being of the advantaged group causally depends upon the deprivations of the disadvantaged. There's a causal connection. They are well off because the poor are badly off. These aren't independent descriptions. Now, you can see the grasshopper and the ant story doesn't satisfy this. The ant is not well off because the grasshopper is badly off. The grasshopper is badly off because the grasshopper was lazy in the summer. That's why the grasshopper was badly off, not because of any relationship. There's no inverse interdependence of the well-being. That's the first criterion. The second criterion is called the exclusion principle. The causal relation in A that we've just described, the causal relation involves the exclusion of the disadvantaged group from access to certain important productive resources controlled by the advantaged group. Certain important resources. So that's when the Schmoo becomes part of the story. The advantage of the employer depends upon excluding the potential worker from access to the Schmoo. They have interdependent welfare. There's a causal connection. But that causal connection is tied to the exclusion. That's an opportunity hoarding idea, right? Exclusion from access to a resource. That's the exclusion principle. The final principle is called the labor effort control principle. This can also be called the appropriation principle, if you want to use a fancier word. The causal mechanism which translates B, that is exclusion, into condition A, that is negative inverse interdependent well-being. The causal mechanism which translates condition B into condition A involves the control over the labor effort and the profits from that effort of the disadvantaged group by those who control these productive resources. That is, remember my little allusion to the dog patch person being a Weberian and the capitalist being a Marxist? Well, what this refers to is the ability to appropriate the effort of others by virtue of their exclusion from this important resource. What the employer is worried about is that if schmooze exist, workers won't work hard anymore. And if workers won't work hard anymore, they won't have control over the labor effort and the profits from that effort of the disadvantaged group. They won't work hard anymore. If you have the first two conditions but not the third, you have what can be called non-exploitative oppression. If you have all three, you have exploitation. Let me just illustrate that contrast. Non-exploitative oppression versus exploitation. When Europeans came to North America, they came to a continent which happened to have people in it. And that posed a problem because the people who lived here had access to the crucial resource of the era, which was land. One can say that for the European settlers of North America, their well-being depended upon their ability to exclude the indigenous people from access to this crucial productive resource. Right? So that's what happened. Settlers came in, they pushed the indigenous people, Native Americans, off the land and continually pushed them westward. That was the central story of European settlement in North America and elsewhere, not just North America. The exclusion of indigenous people from the land. But with rare exceptions, those indigenous people who were pushed off the land were not brought back onto the land as laborers. In the U.S. South, it was not the case that when the Cherokees were pushed off of the land, they were brought back on as slaves. No, they were just pushed off of the land. They weren't turned into slaves, they were just excluded. The result is that we can say that indigenous people in the United States, when the colonization of the territories occurred, when the European settler coloners developed, they were oppressed but not exploited. The white settlers didn't depend upon the labor of indigenous people. Their well-being did depend upon the deprivations of the indigenous people, but not on their labor. So indigenous people were oppressed but not exploited. Now that's quite different from parts of the world where the white settlers did not only deprive the indigenous people of the land, but then brought them back onto the land as the laborers. In the latter case, when that happens, the white settlers need the indigenous people. They depend upon them because their labor, their effortful labor, is what provides for the wealth of the settlers. This is a crucial difference between what happened in North America and what happened in Southern Africa. In Southern Africa, the white settlers subordinated the indigenous population. In North America, they simply excluded them. Now, one of the consequences of simply excluding is that when conflicts arose between indigenous people and the white settlers, there is a solution to that conflict, which is escalating violence to the point of genocide. You know, genocide is an extermination of a people, of one people by another. In North America, in the middle of the 19th century, there was a folk saying that was quite popular, which said, "The only good Indian is a dead Indian." Now, that is a monstrous expression. It was part of our culture. It's part of our past. We need to own that past and recognize what it meant. But the expression, "the only good Indian is a dead Indian," is no different from the Nazi view of Jews. It's a Holocaust ideology that says this is a form of humanity that's best off dead. We should exterminate them. The only good Indian is a dead Indian. That is an expression which, however morally reprehensible it is, it makes sense. You know, you can understand what's being talked about. It's not a crazy thing to say. It's just an abhorrent thing to say. It has a certain kind of rationality to it. And it's a rationality that comes when condition A and B are satisfied in this list of three, but not condition three. Not condition three. It's why, while we can understand, however much we cringe at it, the expression, "the only good Indian is a dead Indian," it would be meaningless to say the only good slave is a dead slave. You know, the Southern slavery was a terribly oppressive and repressive system, but it was also exploitative. And that meant that if you were going to have a slogan of this sort, you would say something like, "The only good slave is a docile slave." The only good slave is a docile slave, but not "the only good slave is a dead slave." That doesn't make any sense. Nor would it make any sense even in an era where there would be sharp conflicts between workers and employers. It would make no sense to say for some you know, robber baron capitalist who hires Pinkerton guards to repressively break up strikes, it would still make no sense for that robber baron to say the only good worker is a dead worker. No, of course not. What they would say is the only good worker is an obedient worker, or the only good worker is a hard-working worker. Those make sense. And the reason they make sense is because, unlike in the case with Native Americans, the advantaged group needs the disadvantaged group. They depend upon them. There's not just this interdependence of their well-being, which is the first principle, that's rooted in exclusion. That's the second principle. There's a much deeper form of interdependence where the advantaged group depends upon the active laboring effort of the disadvantaged group. And then here is a big irony. The dependence of the rich on the poor, I'll say it again, the dependence of the rich on the poor means that this gives the poor a certain form of power. They can resist. I mean, after all, we're not robots. We don't just get programmed with a set of computer codes and then mechanically do our actions. We are human beings that consciously control our muscles and our activities. And as every slave master knew, the slave population had tremendous capacity in all sorts of subtle ways to resist their exploitation. And that posed a problem. And it's why slave systems had to have elaborate systems of domination in place with supervisors and slave drivers and foremen, you know, people just watching and controlling the activities of slaves. And that's because of the capacity to resist. It's why in factories there are elaborate systems of checking up on the labor effort of the workers, of supervisors grading workers, and of imposing fines and discipline. Why is all of that necessary? It's because we're not robots. The capacity to control your own effort is a form of power which affects the relationship between the employer and the employee. And that's this peculiarly complex character about a relationship that includes what I am describing as exploitation, rather than simply domination or exclusion. In a relationship of exploitation, there is reciprocal interactions of an ongoing character between the exploited and the exploiter, in which the well-being of the exploiter depends upon the labor effort of the exploited. They're interdependent in their activities, not just in their well-being. And that's what happens when you add the third criterion, the labor effort control principle, to the first two. Well, that's a really complex set of concepts. And don't worry if it doesn't all feel like it fits together. You'll have a chance in sections to press these issues and to get greater clarity as you think more about it. All right, how do we put these three class processes together? So we looked at three different aspects of class, right? Three different ways of thinking about class. The individual attributes type of class concept. That's the grasshopper and the ants story. The opportunity hoarding class concept, that's where you control some resource and can exclude others. And the domination and exploitation approach to class. Now let's see how these actually can fit together. First, the exploitation-domination approach identifies the fundamental class division in a capitalist economy. The division between capitalists and workers. This is a class relation. It's a social relation. You can't define the category capitalist without defining the category worker and vice versa. You can think of it as employers and employees if you want to use those terms. You know, it doesn't matter so much what the term is that you label this relationship. What matters is that you understand it's a social relation. And it's a social relation that's bound together by relations of domination and exploitation. Second, the opportunity hoarding approach identifies the central processes that differentiates middle-class jobs from the broader working class. So in the first criteria, in the first exploitation domination, you only have two classes in the economy. You have capitalists who own the means of production and everybody else, practically. What the opportunity hoarding approach does is tells us how we should make differentiations among this very large population that we can call the broader working class. It helps us to identify the central processes that differentiate middle-class jobs from the broader working class. And finally, the individual attributes approach identifies the key processes through which people get sorted into these positions. That's how I fit together these three approaches to class. Well, what's the payoff of all this? How do we understand what does the American class structure look like today? If we think of the class structure in terms of these kinds of categories. The class structure in the United States today. First, the capitalist class. We have an extremely rich and powerful capitalist class and corporate managerial class. The American class structure is highly polarized at the top. So we're not just a capitalist economy in which we have a capitalist class that an investor class, if you will, a class that owns the wealth that's deployed in the economic sphere. I am including the what can be called the corporate managerial class as a closely connected to the capitalist class. And the characteristic of the American class structure is that this is an extremely rich and powerful capitalist class. Highly polarized at the top. By polarized at the top, I mean that the wealthiest of the wealthy are unbelievably wealthy. You saw that from the little video we looked at last time. Second, we have a historically vibrant middle class, the middle class being understood in terms of that opportunity hoarding segment of the broader notion of an employee class or working class, or as some people like to say, working people. The middle class is historically vibrant, but currently really much more precarious than it has been in the past. That's part of the sense of pessimism that one sees within at least segments of the middle class, where they see future prospects as not so much, not just mainly that it seems less affluent, but it seems more precarious. I think the notion of insecurity and precariousness probably matters more than just the sheer economic level that people expect to have. Third, we have a working class that was previously protected by unions with a standard of living that overlapped the middle class. So a characteristic of the American working class in the recent past was that in terms of material conditions of life, there was a very big overlap between the middle class and the working class. Indeed, an overlap such that many people in the working class would say they were middle class. And that is a kind of standard way of thinking about it, that the working class became a middle class. That was the previous situation. Now, most of those protections have declined or disappeared, and the working class itself, therefore, is also in an increasingly precarious position. Then we have a category that we can call the working poor, which is a growing precarious segment of the working class. It's people that have to take on several jobs in order to make an adequate standard of living, in which they can't count on hours, and in which within work they have almost no protections around labor standards and working conditions. And finally, we have a category that we can call the underclass, a marginalized, impoverished, oppressed part of the population, largely excluded from employment. We have, by every indicator, the largest proportion of our population that's marginalized in this way of any rich country. And this means that the American class structure is highly polarized at the bottom, not just at the top. At the top, we have a spectacularly and historically unprecedented concentration of wealth at the very, very top. And at the bottom, we have a spectacularly poor and impoverished segment of the population. It's polarized at both ends of the distribution. And that's the American class structure today. See you next week, where we will be exploring the causes and character of inequality and poverty and what to do about it.